Hey, welcome to another week of Fox on Sports. I am Lauren Fox.
I'm Andrew Hansen.
And I wanted to talk about you and the fight that you got into. I'm kidding. The T-ball game earlier this season over at McKelvey.
Right.
Like, I mean, I know it can get tough with a bunch of five-year-olds out there on the field, but I mean...
Yeah, arguing safe out at first. I mean, a lot of conflict.
Right. Everybody hits. Even if you make an out, you still get on base. So, yeah, and in light of the fact that this, well, I don't know. I spend most of my waking hours at baseball fields, I feel like, or baseball facilities, or doing something baseball related. Like, as much as I realize that I actually have work to do, I'm still there because kids. And, you know, you'll get there soon enough. But so this weekend, it was a softball tournament or a baseball tournament or another potential baseball tournament. And you look at it and really appear... What it sort of amounts to, and I guess this has been all over the place, what it really amounts to is you want to get your kid the best opportunity to play. And knowing, you know, being mindful that, hey, very few, and the one real true exception that I would say here is Grant Levine, who drafted at the end of the first round last year. But like we talked about it last week, Grant was a byproduct of hard work, athleticism, and parents who are willing to help out, parents who are willing to commit. Like, just because I want to be 7 foot tall and play in the NBA, that doesn't make me 7 foot tall and able to play in the NBA. Even if I am 7 foot tall, I mean, you've known guys who are 7 foot tall, so have I, who couldn't have played in the NBA if their life depended on it.
Right. Play Division III basketball, don't even get many minutes, and do not play professionally.
Right. And so it's simply because you want it doesn't make it happen. It's a byproduct of a lot of hard work and really commitment to a goal. And so you see what happened in Colorado this past week, and a mutual friend of ours sent it over to us because he's dialed into everything possible that happens in the news front. This was out in Lakewood, Colorado, which is it's Colorado. I mean, you figure that everybody would be pretty mellow out there, but...
Pretty happy. Generally, lots of sun. It's a sunshine state.
It's nicer, warmer, like, hey...
Of the West.
We're good. Everything should be fine out there. And you have two sets of parents at a seven-year-old baseball game. Now, I think about, we sent pictures around earlier this week, and I sent them, I had four guys that I coached with in T-ball, A-ball, AA-ball, AAA. We split up for the first year of majors, and then we brought the band back together for the last year of majors more because we wanted to all be together and go out how we came in, really, than anything else. And a picture showed up on my Facebook feed of the AA championship game. And I remember being in the thick of the AA championship game going, all right, I want to win because the kids want to win. And it would be really nice to be able to win and get this championship. But at the end of it, a AA here is basically what chronologically is baseball 8. And as your kids get older, you'll become familiar with all these terms. Baseball 8 and softball 8 and hockey 8 are all different things because they all have slightly different age cutoffs and it's utterly impossible to navigate. But so I think about where we were at the end of that AA season, and the picture came across, and you look at these kids and you look at these little shiny faces and you go, these are little people. These are little tiny people who are impressionable people who are still trying to figure out what's going on. And we can all look back, and I can look back now with two kids who are 13 and 10 and say there are mistakes that I've made along the way, things that I said that I shouldn't have said, ways that I acted that I shouldn't have, hopefully that I learned from those. But then I take the 8-year-old group and I dial back 1 year to a 7-year-old group, which is in the town of Bedford. We play it up at Legacy Field, and it's coach pitch, and it's fun. It's more about hanging out and watching your kids and laughing and joking. And there are some kids at that point, usually it's the ones with older brothers or older sisters who have played a lot, who are forced to catch up. And those are the best kids in the league. And then you have some kids who just really haven't played a whole lot. And it's a matter of, okay, how do we help the better kids grow and continue to become good players while also making sure that the kids who are the less experienced kids get experience playing the game and learn to love it and want to come back every week and don't get hurt by the kids who are used to throwing to their older siblings. And so what happened in Lakewood, Colorado this week, you sit there and you say, dude, what is going on here?
Yeah, because the bottom line of what you're talking about and describing is at that seven-year-old level, you are at the very beginning stages of development still. Not only baseball, but how to play, how to be a teammate, how to act.
It's critical at that age that, and I still, my goal, and anybody that I've ever coached should be aware of it, my goal is to get you to come back the next time. And I said it to the district kids last year and the kids that I coached the end of the year last year, because there was no next year. It wasn't who's going to sign up and you get the hands raised. It was who's going to keep playing, and when you're our age, who's going to sign up and check the box to coach? Like, because if you don't have people who legitimately love the game dies. It will not continue to grow. And so at that young age, it's about getting them back and making it fun. And okay, Johnny likes to, you're not doing serious drills. Nobody is making the major leagues out of winning a 7-year-old championship or an 8-year-old championship or a 12-year-old championship. And somebody sent me something over. It was a parody website called the Dingerville Times. Did I send that to you?
No.
It was a major league first round left-hander draft status drops because he played on a losing 13U team.
Right.
It's like the Onion for sports. But you look at that and you say, yeah, it matters. And no kid wants to lose all the time, but it's what did you learn from it? And as they get older, what you take out of every game changes. When you're seven, it really is there pizza? Is there ice cream? And did you hit the ball? And that's it.
But that wasn't it in Colorado.
No. So in Colorado, you you had two teams that were arguing with each other, and not the kids, the parents, because parents ruin everything. And I'm 100% confident that if you just took 18 kids out there and said, go play, the kids would have played without issue. And if you would come back in an hour and you would have said, hey, Joey, where did we wind up? The kids know the score. Don't get me wrong. Like anybody who says that even if you're not keeping score, that the kids aren't paying attention. Oh, the kids are paying attention. The kids know what the score is. Like they are acutely aware, more so often than parents or umpires are. But if you had left and given the kids an hour, they would have had different rules and come up with, well, we decided that if the ball hits the whatever out in left field, that that's a home run or that's a ground rule double or this or that. Like they would have resolved conflicts, but the grownups can't resolve conflicts.
No.
We're miserable at that.
At least not without a melee.
No. So you had parents that looked like an episode of Cops beating on each other. The only seemingly logical human being, and it's sad, was the umpire who's 13, who seems like a super sharp kid. And you say, why would you ever expect, if you were going to go umpire a game, that would be what you would encounter? I've encountered weird things. I've encountered parents yelling at each other, and you have to say, hey, dial it back. I've encountered people yelling at me. Although, by and large, as much as people say parents can be difficult if you're umpiring, they are generally not. If you prepare for it. But it generally, they aren't. But the fact that, okay, out of this whole thing, you have this altercation where parents were using foul language with each other. The umpire warned both sets of parents, don't use foul language. That turned into a full-scale brawl on the field. I don't know who shows up at a Little League field and goes, I'm going to beat somebody's head in today.
I'm looking for a fight.
I'm looking for a fight. I'm not feeling very peaceful, so I want to beat someone.
Jeez.
So, yeah, so that was what happened. The sad thing about it is now you have however many kids are on both teams, I'm going to guess 22, 24, who may not want to play baseball again when mom and dad go to sign them up.
Yeah, that might have been a little bit traumatic for those kids.
They're done. Like, why would you? Why? And the league kicked both teams out.
Right. Their seasons are finished.
Which, that's not cool for the kids. Like, what if you have a kid who really wanted to play? Like, I was out yesterday with Maggie and one of her friends and her younger brother and another 8-year-old, 9-year-old. They love the game, too. Like, it really is a punishment when you take that away from kids, and try explaining to it, like, yeah, your season's over and there's no more baseball. Why? Because a bunch of grown men decided to get into a fight during your game on the field.
Yeah, it's guilty by association.
That's something that happens in life and something that is a valuable lesson to learn, but not when you're seven. When you're seven, that's a really difficult concept.
Absolutely.
So, but yeah, it's I think yesterday we were messing around at one of the indoor facilities in the afternoon, and the kids wanted to play wiffle ball, and they played wiffle ball, and I sat there and talked with an adult, and the kids sat there and made their own rules about, you know, they were experimenting with something with the strike zone. Well, this doesn't work. Well, is it okay? Are you out if I hit you with the ball, or if are you out if I catch a ground ball and throw it to the pitcher before you get to first? Like, they're sitting there sorting out the rules and arguing, and they might have disagreed at the beginning, but they figure out a way to agree on it. I mean, it's like, isn't that how stuff should work as opposed to what happened in Colorado?
Yeah, that's the fun part. That's how you develop. That's how you learn and you grow with your peers.
So anyway, and I guess speaking of, we'll flip it, because we had out in Colorado, you had the non-supportive parents, or parents who probably misguidedly thought that they were supporting their children and were doing it completely wrong to, you're doing it wrong, that word. I do not think it means what, it does not mean what you think it means. But the parents of the kids drafted in the NBA yesterday, that was, I almost, and I said it off air and I'll say it again. It was, I sometimes feel like Maria Taylor is trying to be like Roy Firestone and Jerry Maguire when she has Rod Tidwell. She's like, Roy Firestone's trying to make Rod cry or trying to make Jerry cry later. It's like they know kind of what the buttons are that you're trying to push. And it happened. We saw it during the Masters. Tiger won, and everybody just kept trying to poke. Like, how can we get this guy to cry?
Right.
And it was not successful.
Yeah.
The tactic of getting players to cry was far more successful yesterday.
It was. It was the theme of the night with the interviews. And it was a little bit different setting. You know, Maria Taylor was the one interviewing, and it was more of a spotlight situation than in previous years. They dedicated a minute or so to interviewing each of the lottery picks, 1 through 14, and it started with Zion. And you're right, the parents were there in the background. She would invite them up, and then with a handful of those picks, there were some losses in the family.
Oh, yeah.
There were all kinds of issues that she honed in on, knowing that it was a part of the emotional experience for them. And it started with Zion. He showed his emotions. I thought it was great, just real. And then I think the other young drafted players saw that, and they realized it was okay. And then before you know it, a handful of them are doing the same thing with their parents. But yeah, that was one of the themes of the night for sure.
It so watching Zion, and you watch him and you become aware, okay, he's 18. And I can't imagine the dumb things that would have come out of my mouth at 18 years of age, and because they come out on the radio every week for an hour. But I look at Zion and I say he knows what to say. He innately knows what to say, knows how to handle himself. You get the feeling that this guy kind of says, all right, here I am, and I have an opportunity to play basketball, but I don't, he's one. Yeah, you can talk about what he'll accomplish on the court, but I really do think he's got a gigantic heart, and the things that he will accomplish off the court really have a chance to dwarf what he does on the court, because he just is he's a really magnetic dude.
Oh, so magnetic. And on and off the court, I think he's got great charisma. I really like the quote he had coming in, walking in, where he said, time is going slow and fast at the same time.
Yeah.
It's that
I'm waiting. I want it to get there, but this is really all happening too quick.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And then he had he had that quote, then he had the emotions, and then he came back on set with the guys and he gave some genuine answers.
Yeah.
You know, talking about how he wants to be the best, so he wants to try and earn respect from all the other players in the NBA.
Yeah.
And he's the heir apparent to LeBron in being the generational talent that every little kid looks up to, but he's still humble.
Yeah.
And it's natural. And I heard an interview from Coach K where he really went out of his way to say, I love him as a person.
Yeah.
And he loved being around him every day. And I think New Orleans is thrilled. They were jumping in the streets and dancing at the news that they were going to get him.
Well, they do that every day.
Yeah,
it's
but
New
I
Orleans.
Mean.
Can we, so I'm going to make an early birthday request. I want to go to a Pelicans game.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
They are going to be fun.
That's what I just, I, you know, I don't need to, I can't do New Orleans for longer than about 2 days.
So you're perfect.
My liver cannot handle New Orleans for longer than about 2 days. Go for the weekend. Go to a Pelicans game. Just laugh. Go to Frenchman Street. Like, I'm in. Hook it up. Let's go.
Everybody there is going to be in a great mood after the arrival of David Griffin, the ping pong balls dropping so that they get the number one pick. It's been a dream come true spring and early summer for the Pels. And what they did with Anthony Davis is textbook. It's how you draw it up. It's really amazing what they did, because what they were starting with, yes, so they get the number one pick and they get Zion. So that's just amazing, game changer right there. But then they've got the Anthony Davis drama. And what happened last year was just terrible for the franchise. They were in shambles. And he comes in with the challenge of, all right, what can I get for Anthony Davis? First, he tries to convince him to stay.
Well, unfortunately, and we'll even walk it back further, they had Dell Demps running things, and Dell Demps had been under the thumb, so to speak, of the New Orleans Saints football operations guys. And this is no indictment of Dell Demps' skill as a basketball man, knowledgeable guy. It really is that he got sort of pegged into a bad situation and was really sort of hamstrung by the ownership. David Griffin is a guy who came in with a lot of experience, a great basketball resume, and I have no doubt that when he took the job, he said, yeah, I'll take the job, but I'm taking it under these conditions.
Right.
And you will let me make the basketball decisions. And they said, hey, if you're serious about winning, this is a great guy to have, but you can't mess with a plan that he's got in place. You got to let him just execute his plan.
Right. He had to have the autonomy. He got it, and he's showing why they made a good decision in giving it to him. So they're sitting there with Anthony Davis, and yes, he's a star, but he only has 1 year left on his contract. So the clock is ticking. The pressure is on the Pelicans to get value for one of the five or six best players in the NBA. So they've got that as an asset, and then they've got Solomon Hill, who's just an average player with a big salary that nobody wants, and the number 57 pick in last night's draft. So those are the three assets, really, that they're going to trade. But if you look at the big picture, what do they get for Anthony Davis, this average player Solomon Hill, and almost the last pick in the draft last night? They get Lonzo Ball, Brandon Ingram, Josh Hart, the fourth pick in the draft, which they then traded to Atlanta. They get the eighth pick, the 17th pick, the 35th pick, and a first-round pick next year. And then they used the picks last night to get Jackson Hayes, the center out of Texas, who's a freak athlete, could be a starter next year, alongside Zion, and create one of the most athletic front courts in the NBA. Then they get Nikhil Alexander Walker, the 17th pick from Virginia Tech, who seems like one of these glue combo guards who's going to be a rotation player. 35th pick, this kid out of Brazil. Don't know much about him, but they turned Anthony Davis, with 1 year left on his contract, to potentially six or seven rotation players. That's outstanding.
Well, you think about when that's happened in the past with other sports, and it's not without precedent. Like, you look at the Rams in the 80s trading Eric Dickerson and getting a bunch of guys that turned into Flipper Anderson and Aaron Cox, and all of a sudden the Rams went from a run first team with really nothing surrounding it to a very good team for a number of years because of it. The Cowboys, Vikings, Herschel Walker, Ricky Williams, the Saints, like over and over and over again, this sort of thing has happened. Sometimes it's successful and it provides building blocks. Sometimes teams squander the great opportunity. Obviously, a bunch of these guys haven't played a game in the NBA yet. But you look at it now, you say they really want it. And not to mention the Lakers, because of their sort of pathological need to get this deal done, now left themselves where they're trying to reverse course and create a third max space that should have been there for them to begin with. If they had waited a few days, now they're just kind of hosed and they're going back to New Orleans and asking New Orleans to rework the deal. Like, okay, first of all, Rob Pelinka, you're an agent. You should have known this sort of stuff anyway. Second of all, you're not a one-man show. Like, there are other people that can make decisions and override you. And I have no doubt that Pelinka is dealing with a front office and ownership that may have said, hey, we need to get this thing done. and people underneath him who were saying, you can't do it yet. Like, just wait, just wait. And he went ahead and did it. And now the Lakers really have a strong possibility of being LeBron and Anthony Davis and a bunch of scraps.
Right. Kyle Kuzma, assuming he stays, and then a bunch of minimum salary players that they're going to have to find from who knows where. But you're right. They completely fumbled it with the timing of it and how it's going to be executed. And it just goes back to how brilliant this is from the Pelicans' perspective, because they were really losing all their leverage because Anthony Davis' agent came out and say he's not going to re-sign with Boston. So one of the biggest suitors out there is really out of the mix.
Right.
It was only the Lakers. And it was almost like they just kept bidding against themselves more and more. Yeah, they wanted to get it done. Yeah, they had to get AD there to pair with LeBron. So they got what they wanted, but they absolutely overpaid.
They really overpaid. And you know, the other thing that they've done, and this is kind of classic new Laker that wouldn't have happened in the 80s, but the Lakers, it seems like every time they got a high draft pick, it succeeded for them. And this was back when they were good. They had the number one in 79. That was Magic. They had the number one in 82. That was James Worthy. Like, they picked, I want to say Byron Scott, they got in trade from, I almost called him Kansas City, but I think they were Sacramento at that point. And they got Byron Scott. Byron Scott was like the fourth or fifth pick overall. They built building blocks by not squandering great draft pick opportunities. And even you look at Kobe, and it was funny to watch it yesterday. It was like watching NBA Jam. Kobe's walking up in a Charlotte Hornets hat, and the Lakers had set up that trade where Kobe wasn't actually going to be a Hornet. He was going to be a Laker. But
with, like, what, the 13th pick?
It was a mid-first round pick. But they were always smart about how they did it. Even you look late in the draft, drafting kind of a scrappy guard out of Arkansas Little Rock, Derek Fisher, who became a staple with the franchise for a really long time.
Won lots of championships.
Won lots of championships. They were just smart with how they did it. And they had a bad few years, and they drafted really poorly. If you draft differently in the last few years, you don't need Anthony Davis. If you draft somebody who isn't Lonzo Ball, second. If you draft somebody
Jason Tatum, who
isn't Brandon Ingram, third. If you draft somebody who isn't Josh Hart, I think Josh Hart was fourth, fifth. Like, they got guys who are good, but when you're selecting a lottery pick, you're not selecting a good player. Like, you're selecting an ace, cleanup hitter, Gold Glover, but you're not selecting a guy who's going to be a sixth man.
Right. Those are the picks that are more 15 and onward, unless you get Kawhi Leonard or Giannis.
Well, unless you're the Spurs or you get Manu or, like, right. You know, some of the teams have done very well with those picks because they mine talent really well.
Yeah, in general, right. That's why they break it down lottery 1 through 14. You're looking for the star. After that, you're generally looking for the role player. Maybe you get a diamond in the rough, you get a star. But that's what the Celtics were looking at with their picks, 14, 20, and 22. And it's going to be fun to see how this plays out for the Celtics. And first of all, on a big picture with the Celtics, I hear a lot of these comments about, is it now a rebuild? Is it time to rebuild? Because Kyrie's apparently leaving. Al Horford is apparently leaving. I don't think it's anywhere close to time for rebuild. I think that's absurd talk. I mean, you still have Jason Tatum, who is a star in the making.
Jalen Brown,
who...
We were talking about this yesterday. It's funny. Yeah.
If he can get it together, has immense talent upside. Gordon Hayward, who, if he continues to get healthy, is an all-star player. Marcus Smart, who's an incredible defender. I mean, there's four really great pieces right there that you're building around. I mean, that is your core. That's a great core.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, what was the problem last year? We had too many great players. So now you subtract two of them, one of whom was allegedly a real cancer in terms of chemistry. And so now all of a sudden you're a rebuild? Aren't you more really streamlined to where you want to be? Now we have four upper echelon star type players. That's what you want for your core.
Right.
Six was too many.
Yeah.
So
I mean,
now four is rebuild?
I think they're actually in a really good position, not to mention, for whatever reason, Kyrie just didn't click.
The coaching staff, with the other players.
The fans didn't like...
No, it didn't work.
He'd have a handful of good games, and nobody would say anything about it, and then he'd have a couple bad games, and that would be all anybody wanted to talk about. Kyrie's biggest fans are our kids.
Right.
Like, I see more kids walking around wearing Kyrie shirts. And I think he's not the one. He's honestly, he would be an interesting fit as that third max guy down in L.A. If
right.
Palinka hadn't. Like,
he's an excellent sidekick.
He would be an amazing sidekick, but he's just not. I don't know. He just can't have everything on him all the time.
If he goes to Brooklyn without somebody like Durant, they're going to be a 7 or 8 seed. They're not going to do anything.
Yeah.
I don't understand what he's thinking. I mean, yeah, he wants to go home and be in Brooklyn and New York. So that's fine. But they're not going to be anywhere close to a contender. They'd have to add Durant and more.
Right.
So I think the Celtics are in a much better place than the Nets. I think it's shaping up well. Now they're going to have cap space. And here's what I think they should do. Re-sign Rozier.
Yes.
And then go get your big in free agency that you got to fill the void that Horford has left. So how about Vucevic from Orlando? I mean, there's all this talk about Anthony Davis, who's obviously a level above Vucevic, but he's 25-12. What about Vucevic's numbers? Look at this. He's 20.8 points last year, 12 rebounds, 3.8 assists, 52% from the field, 36% three-point shooter, 79% at the line. That's an excellent stat line for a big athletic center who can move well, no issues chemistry wise. So if you can get him for let's say you get him for $20 million a year, you would have had to pay Horford $25 million a year probably on a long term deal. I think you're potentially making an upgrade. I mean, Horford is a great chemistry guy, great teammate, so that's a big loss. But if you can fill that starting lineup with Rozier and Vucevic, and you've got these three young guys in the draft who have a lot of potential, I think you're looking great. I can't wait to see what these guys are going to turn out to be. Romeo Langford, the 14th pick from Indiana, did not shoot well at all from three-point land, 27%. But he's one of those combo guards who can create, and you know, he's Mr. Basketball in Indiana.
I was going to say, I did enjoy watching him in college. He is definitely, he's a playmaker.
Right.
Like, that's it. And he's useful in that role. I do think they have a number of guys who sort of fit into that role, which makes it a slightly more puzzling pick. But
you don't need him to come in and be a starter.
That's the thing.
Right? If you have Rozier and Marcus Smart and Tatum and Brown and Hayward and
You still have Brad Stevens. And
right.
You also, and this is the piece that we haven't really talked about yet, you have the addition by subtraction piece.
Exactly.
No Kyrie, sucking all the oxygen out of the room.
Right. So you bring Romeo Langford as your first guard off the bench. Doesn't have to be a starter as a rookie. Then you've got Grant Williams, the 22 pick from Tennessee, SEC Player of the Year, 6'7", 240, perfect for the modern NBA. He's strong enough to guard power forwards.
He's a funny dude, too.
He's 3 assists a game, so he can pass. Good shooter. Really smart guy, apparently.
He loves playing video games. He'll play Fortnite with David Price.
And then you've got Carson Edwards at the 33 pick.
I didn't see that. I like him. He's solid out of Purdue.
I mean, he's a great scorer. We saw that in the NCAA tournament. He went nuts.
Yeah,
with
these
40-point games.
He was the one who was basically giving Purdue the shot.
Yeah, put Purdue on his back. So he's a clutch player. He's small. So, you know, I don't know about the athleticism. Maybe he won't be a starter, but you could certainly see him as a backup point guard.
The theme that I saw, and we talked about Josh Jackson last week and the athleticism of Jackson, the theme that I saw in this year's draft was kind of what you and I talked about last week, was all of a sudden the variable that we're scoring high is fault correction and hard work, or variables that we're scoring high, fault correction and hard work. It's the guys who don't say, I'm here, great, I'm in the NBA, I've hit my goal. It's the guys who look at it and say, all right, how do I elevate myself to the next level? And it's a difficult thing. And it's become, I guess, as I have grown and my kids have grown, that's the thing that I see as it comes to sports, whether it's gymnastics, and I look at Libby and I look at her do whatever flippy, spinny thing she does, and it looks good to me. But the score comes out and you figure out, okay, there's this and that she needs to work on. And that's what separates me being an untrained eye from me watching Simone Biles and saying, God, that's an amazing gymnast. It's a knowledge of this is what I need to work on and this is what I need to fix to improve myself and get myself to the next level. And I see it with baseball where, okay, the game tells you. The game tells you pretty obviously. You can't hit a curveball. Guess what? Figure out a way to hit a curveball. Like, but it's not a, well, I'm here and I have great bat speed. Like, we have so many analytical tools now, whether, you know, I joke with Maggie all the time. She's seen her swing infinitely more times than I have. I've never seen my swing on video. I don't want to. I've never seen myself throw a baseball on video. I don't want to. But the kids now have access, and athletes now have access to so many tools biomechanically to make themselves improve. And now it's just a matter of, okay, the tools are here. You've been given them. And think about how much more we know about physical fitness and strength and fast twitch, slow twitch, and various exercise regimens. And there are so many different things we know that we can improve upon. You have the tools. It's the athletes that choose to use them who are going to improve and get better. And that's why North Carolina, you know, we saw it. Coby White gets drafted 7th. His teammate goes 11th. And he's amazed about this. But Johnson doesn't go 11th if he's not a hard worker.
Right.
Like, that was the skill that was praised there. And as much as I love Manute Bol back in the day, and I do think Bol Bol is going to be a very good player in the NBA, but sometimes teams look at it and say, well, we need impact now. And if this guy isn't going to work hard enough to get over the hump or hasn't said the right things to us, well, maybe this guy isn't the right guy. And maybe the wake-up call he needs is being drafted 44th.
Right. That was tough for him. But
so bad. Not to mention wearing the suit. It was like Thurman Thomas in the NFL draft in like 87.
Yeah. So a couple of the points you hit on there with the technology and seeing your swing. The thing that jumped out at me with this draft is you heard the comments about, oh, it's really a three-man draft. Those top three picks are going to be stars. And then after that, nobody to really get excited about. I think this could turn out to be one of the deepest drafts in NBA history. The guys from, well, let's start with number 11, the guy you're just talking about, Cameron Johnson at UNC. He's like 6'9". And you talk about his hard work. He shot 46% on three-pointers
last year. I think I look at him and I go, that's Klay Thompson.
He's a phenomenal shooter.
Right.
So he goes 11, and it was a surprise to many that he went that high. But don't you want guys like that who can shoot? And so he's at number 11. Bol Bol's number 44. But from 11 to 44, there are a lot of guys who I think could be very, very good NBA players. I mean, just right before Bol Bol, you've got Eric Pascal at 41, who we talked about last year with Jim Hlavik, the guy out of Villanova who is funny. The guy who I had compared him to is Draymond Green. Now he's going to Golden State. When he comes off the bench next year, you're going to think, is Draymond Green still on the court? I mean, that's the type of player he is. They got him at 41. Then the next pick was Admiral Schofield, 42, out of Tennessee.
He's solid.
I like him a lot.
He was. The only thing that concerns me with guys, there are some guys who you almost, and I don't know if this is accurate. It's just from, I don't know, almost 40 years of watching NCAA tournament games. Sometimes you watch a guy and you sort of get a feeling like this is his ceiling. I love his game. I got that. And I like, he was the reason that I wanted Tennessee to do well. Cause like him and Grant Williams, I'm like, I love these guys. These are just ballers. But really the weird feeling, and I have nothing statistically to back anything up about it, was that this is sort of his ceiling. He reminds me of a bunch of guys that I've, an amalgam of guys that I've seen over the years who that's about where they level off. But again, it's, will he find sort of the fire in the belly to take him to that next level in the NBA, and can he get there?
Well, that's the thing. You're talking about him in normal years as if he was the 14th pick, like last pick of the lottery. Did we reach for this guy? You know,
right.
He doesn't have an ultimate ceiling, but he's the 42nd pick. And that's the point I'm trying to make is you've got these guys who very easily could be very solid players
right.
at 42. Normally, you don't have that at 42. You have, a European guy who's 18 years old. You're going to stash him in Europe for 2 years and hope that he develops physically, but he never does. You never hear from him again.
Yes. Looking at the draft, and somehow I missed Carson Edwards out of the whole thing anyway, but looking at the names, it was, oh, wait, I forgot about him. He's still on the board. It almost, in a lot of ways, it felt like a fantasy draft when you're like, I'm really hoping I have this guy who I didn't pick, and I'm hoping that nobody's able to read my mind and pick him right before I pick, because that's just going to mess me up.
I kind of thought that maybe that's what was happening to the Celtics. You know, you get that classic fantasy draft where the guy before you picks the guy you're planning on multiple times.
Yes.
I thought that might have happened with them, because the 13th pick was Tyler Hero, this great shooter out of Kentucky.
Yep.
And Miami took him at 13. The Celtics had the 14th pick. So I wonder if they would have taken him if he was still there. And then they're coming up at 20 and 22. And who was it that was picked at that point? 21 pick was Brandon Clark. Memphis took him. So Brandon Clark is this, again, he was maybe one of the best athletes in this draft. Great rebounder, shot blocker, steals. So he's sort of like the Swiss Army knife defender who's going to do all the dirty work. So he was at 21. They were set to pick at 22, and you wonder if they would have taken him. So the guys like that, you know, that's the sense I had as we're going through the draft of trying to predict who the Celtics weren't going to pick. But they still ended up with three guys who are, again, potentially solid rotation players for a long time.
Yeah, so it will be, and of course, only time will tell. Only time will tell if Zion is able to change the sartorial splendor of man wearing the slick white suit.
Yeah,
it's
smooth.
Yeah, no, it's sometimes little things. Men used to wear hats all over the place with their suits. JFK didn't wear a hat. Nobody wears hats anymore. Like, you never know. You never know where it's going to come from. So, but
speaking of clothing, so I've got my Kansas Jayhawks shirt on today.
Did anybody even go?
That's why I'm wearing it.
Okay.
First year since 2009 that no Kansas Jayhawks were drafted. So kind of a sad day for Jayhawk Nation.
It is, but I guess. I mean, who are they losing?
Well, that freshman Grimes came out and didn't get drafted.
Did he sign with an agent?
I don't know. Okay. I haven't followed up on that. I saw a clip of him at the draft combine scrimmaging, and so I haven't read to see what's happening with him. A little bit of a wake-up call. Typically, Kansas produces a lottery pick.
Right.
Or two.
But
Wiggins and Embiid.
Right, but you look at the recent past, and I don't know. I mean, and I'd have to go back through. They have not been the best at churning out NBA prospects. They just haven't.
Well, they've got these highly ranked amateurs who come in.
Yes.
So they're stocked with the type of roster that Duke and Kentucky and North Carolina have. But you're right. They're not. It's either the type of guy that they've been getting recently, like Wiggins, who we've talked about multiple times, that just doesn't have the drive and the motor to be a great.
No.
Sort of like since Paul Pierce, the type of star they've had has been more like Andrew Wiggins than Paul Pierce. The only outlier there is Embiid, who didn't get to play much for the Jayhawks, but he's the one guy who is an absolute star, pillar of a franchise, game-changer NBA player.
Right. But you think, though, about all these years of... Nick Collison had a great career and hung on for a long time, but nobody would ever mistake Nick Collison for a star. You had Michael Lee, you had Wayne Simien, you had Mario Chalmers, who I think is still kicking around somewhere. You had, like, there have been a number of guys who have hung out in the league. When I said Michael Lee, I was thinking more along the lines of, like, guys who have been sort of the guy. Devontae Graham. Like, the guys have been nice players, but I don't think anybody's getting super crazy about them. And it almost makes you think, all right, you have a team that underperforms just about every year in the NCAA tournament and now isn't spitting guys out to the pros. Just saying. I don't know.
Scoreboard.
Yeah. I don't know. It might not be too late to bring Danny Manning in.
Yeah. Hey.
I would be fine with that.
Things were good when he was on campus.
Right. I'm just... Like, but I don't think there's just something. It's just, yeah.
Well, there was that report that
something is rotten in Denmark.
There's that report that after the trial in New York with the corruption and the college coaches and paying kids to go to certain schools, that maybe there are going to be five or six more schools that the NCAA is going to start investigating even further. And would not surprise me at all if Kansas is on that list.
Yes. So that would make March sad.
Yes.
At least in the Fox house as well as the Hanson house, but...
Well, so on a the other reason, of course, I'm wearing this shirt, we talked about Jayhawks. On a brighter note,
yes,
for the Jayhawk alums, U.S. Open Golf.
Yes.
Gary Woodland, the Jayhawk.
Yep. He barely beat out Bruce Koepka. Bruce played well. Yeah. I mean, you got to hand it to Bruce. He's a good
Bruce
golfer.
Guy,
Bruce is really good.
He's won, what, four majors recently?
Bruce is really good.
I mean, he's a household name, that Bruce Koepka.
Yeah. Yeah. Because there are a lot of people naming their kids Bruce 30 years ago.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so anyway, the starter at the U.S. Open.
In the awards ceremony.
Oh, that's right. That's right. But he handled it well. Like he
just laughed like, oh, here we go again.
Here we go. Well, yeah, I don't know. I'm used to getting my name misspelled wrong, everything wrong, so I get it. But how do you, he's what? What's his world ranking?
It's maybe two.
Okay.
But he's
got to be top three.
Everybody agrees he's currently the best player on the planet.
He's a beast.
So in your sport, if you're doing an award ceremony at one of the hallowed grounds of golf, Pebble Beach, the 18th green, and you're part of one of the governing bodies of the game, do you think you might be able to know how to pronounce the guy's name?
Or just get it right.
Wow.
Yep. I don't know. I just don't know. Well, and then
we just don't care about him anymore because he came in second.
He came in second.
So we just need to know how to pronounce Gary Woodland.
Gary Woodland, who I'm glad I was able to get that clip because I was watching the end of the U.S. Open and I shot up like it was Sunday night. I was falling asleep and all of a sudden I hear somebody in the background go rock chalk. I'm like, what?
That's
like,
right.
Yeah. So I grabbed my phone and took a video of the TV and sent it to Hanson and call my wife into the room like, oh, my God, you need to hear this.
Yeah, I don't know how I didn't hear that. I was watching it,
yeah.
And I guess I was just focused on how he was playing the 18th hole so wisely, just conservative iron, 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 setting up his birdie.
Making a 30-footer.
Yeah. So really, at nice little finishing touch there.
Yeah, it was solid. And he hit a 3-wood that was one for the ages that I thought...
Back on 14.
It was on 14. I thought it was going to go up along Gene Sarazen's double eagle.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the annals of golf history. Then he hit on 17, the little chip, and...
93 feet.
He's on the green...
93 feet away.
Or he's on the fringe, but chooses to chip because the way that the green sets up, it's like a lima bean... Like the shortest distance between the two points was a straight line
through the sort of the rough and fringe.
Yeah, and he couldn't have got it there.
He
so,
could not have gone straight anywhere towards the pin and gotten his putt anywhere within probably 15 feet because of how it would break.
It is the kind of shot that if you were to hit it, like I've from my days of playing a ton of golf, you encounter things like that and you know you're on the green and you walk up and you say, I have to pack a lunch to get to the hole from here. And, oh, yeah, now, like, you're giggling as you pull your sandwich out of the bag. Like, I have to chip from the green.
Right.
Like, this is dumb.
This is happening. The only way I can get it close is if I chip from the green. I'm on the 71st hole. I'm leading the U.S. Open. And what do? I chip it over the fringe and run it up perfectly next 2 feet below the hole. So I can go tap in for par and go collect my trophy.
Yes.
Just with everything on the line.
It was
That's all.
Ice water in the guy's veins. They did... I don't know if you saw this. He actually, so he played basketball at Washburn.
Yeah.
So he had the same, oddly enough, my wife had a career, college path of KU to Washburn.
The anti-Gary Woodland.
I know, it's the opposite of the Gary Woodland, but they showed him on TV playing against Kirk Heinrich.
Right. Now I heard him talking about that.
Yeah.
That's how, when he was guarding Kirk Heinrich in Allen Fieldhouse, that's when he realized, yeah, maybe basketball isn't the sport for me in terms of becoming a professional.
Bummer.
So let me focus on golf a little bit more.
Yeah. So it's like Hanson on steroids. But yeah, so congratulations to Gary Woodland. That was a lot of fun to see. Major League Baseball, really the news of the week. Well, this has been going on for what, a week and a half? The spat between Unwritten Rules writer and legislator Madison Bumgarner.
Right.
Who determined that Max Muncy watched his home run for too long.
Oh, my gosh.
And starts chirping at Muncy as Muncy drops the bat. And I didn't think he really took a whole lot of a time getting out.
He didn't do anything.
Like,
he just hit the home run.
He hit the home run, dropped the bat.
To gather himself, start to head towards first.
Took a couple steps, and Bumgarner starts yelling at him.
Starts freaking out.
Muncy with the comeback for the ages if you don't like it, you can go get it out of the ocean.
Because it was in San Francisco.
It was in San Francisco.
He'd hit it into the bay. Just destroyed that baseball.
Dude. Yep. You don't like it, go get it out of the ocean.
That was quite a comeback. And fitting because Bumgarner is just coming out of left field with that complaint. I mean, he's all enraged within the split second because Muncy isn't sprinting immediately. I mean, I don't think he had any leg to stand on with him complaining about Muncy's conduct.
I think part of it has to, and if the Giants were in first place and Bumgarner was pitching great, I don't think you would have heard a peep. You might have. He's a little cranky, but I still don't. I think his team being as bad as they are enters into the equation a lot, and I think he's probably frustrated at his performance, and so we'll see. But and then before we take a quick break and come back with Bedford Little League 12-year-old or district coach of the 12-year-old team. He's not 12, Mark St. Hilaire. But College World Series taking place right now, which I always enjoy watching the passion these guys play with, because not everybody, as the NCAA commercials will tell you, not everybody is going pro. A lot of these guys have been drafted. They're still playing hard. Was watching the Mississippi State game last night. Their center fielder was playing in his last college game and was pretty bummed out about the fact he got drafted by the Mets. He'll start his minor league career in a week, but this is a chapter that's over. It's a big deal. So a lot of fun to watch those guys as they go through. Michigan is 2-0 with a very fun team. Guys who, it's just a team of baseball players. I enjoy watching them. And then on the other side, the other undefeated team is Vanderbilt with Kumar Rocker, Tracy Rocker, former NFL defensive lineman. His son is now throwing in the 90s for Vanderbilt. So, I don't know. It's been fun to watch.
Yeah, I haven't been able to watch as much as I'd like because of these other events that we've been talking about. But, yeah, it's a special setting. I went to Omaha. I wanted to go there as a player, but we didn't make it out of the regional. We won a game at the regional in South Carolina my senior year.
Over who?
Over the Citadel.
Oh, wow.
11-7.
Yep.
First tournament victory for Princeton in 36 years.
Yep.
So that was a big deal. And we lost 13-12 to Central Florida, who was the top 10 team. So we were very competitive. Felt like we were good enough to win the regional. And it's the same thing as basketball. It's 64 teams, but you have these quadrants of four to try and get to the super regional. So, a lot of memories there. Omaha is a special place. So nothing quite like it, for sure.
Yeah, certainly, it seems like it's a lot of fun as far as an environment goes. But even playing in the regionals is...
Morning, this is Mark.
Hey, Mark, what's going on? It's Lauren Fox and Andrew Hansen. We're just bringing you on right in the middle, dude.
All right.
We are not live, though.
But we're recording it, so we're sort of live.
All right.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Yeah, so we appreciate you taking the time. We have Mark St. Hilaire with us, who is the coach of the Bedford 12-year-old district team. And thank you for joining us. I know... this time of year, it can be a little bit crazy. Practice every day, not to mention rain, which rain is the worst. But you've been involved with the Bedford Little League. This is year 11, is that right?
Yeah, I think 11, 12 years now, my 12th year.
I mean,
starting with my oldest, so it's been a number of years now.
That's the point when you really just lose count. How have you seen things change in the last 11, 12 years?
Few things, I think. Overall, I'd say, numbers are down a little bit in the league. I remember back, 10, 11 years ago, we probably had over 500 players in our program, and we're probably down to about 450. And then I guess I'd attribute it to, there's other, with the interest of other sports like lacrosse in the spring, a lot of players are playing multiple sports in multiple seasons now with basketball and soccer. So I think overall interest has been down for us. But one thing that we've been trying to do is try and just develop, more of an interest at the younger ages. I think one of the points of emphasis as a league has been is to try and get the younger players more engaged early and to watch to make it, more enjoyable for them, more exciting. Pace of play in baseball is tough. It's tough to keep attention spans of a six-year-old. And, we try and do a lot of things to try and, get that early involvement to get that interest level to start, right from the T-ball age on up.
It makes a big difference. And you talk about it being down a little bit, but when you compare it to other towns, and there are some towns that have either consolidated their little league programs entirely, or have switched over to other options. You know, Bedford hasn't been quite as hard hit as others have. We've still done a good job of involving our kids, but and still making it fun. And of course, I think you probably saw it, the video footage of the fight in Colorado this past week. Hanson and I talked about it earlier. What were your thoughts after seeing that?
Yeah, I did see it. I was horrified. I mean, it's, you know, one of the worst examples of, you know, youth athletics that you can see. And, you know, the thing to me, one of the most unfortunate things is, as you saw it and you read about it, is, you know, the poor umpire in that situation, I think, was a 12 or a 13-year-old, you know, boy or girl that was, you know, they're donating his or her time, right? It's youth athletics and little league baseball. It's all based on and driven by volunteerism. Coaches, officials, you know, the people running the snack shacks, right? And to have a community of people that are surrounding children doing it, you know, as a service to the community, and to have that happen to a kid of that age, it's just deplorable. And it's just things like that just, you know, send all the wrong messages about what it is we're trying to teach the kids. You know, it's not just about the sport itself. It's about community. It's about, you know, friendships. It's about trying to develop some level of interest outside of academics and other things. So I thought it was horrible. Unfortunate, and I think we're fortunate in our town. You know, we've never seen anything like that. Certainly hope we never do. But it causes you to pause. You step back and say, you know, what can I do, you know, as a league official, as a coach, as a parent, to just make sure that doesn't happen, and to talk to your kids about it and say, you know, I think it's a good thing to show that video to your kids and use it as an opportunity to teach them as to, you know, what's right and wrong in terms of athletics and sportsmanship and just being a good person.
Yeah, that negative issue is certainly a learning opportunity, and I think it is smart to talk about it and share it with players. So, Mark, with over a decade of you volunteering with Bedford Little League, you obviously love the game. What do you love most about baseball, and how do you share that love with your players?
Good question. I think I do love baseball. You know, been involved in it since I was a kid. You know, you mentioned T-ball, and I think in some way, shape, or form, since I was a kid, I've always, you know, played it, been around it, followed it. I think, you know, one of the things about baseball, it's a tough sport, and I tell the kids all the time in that, unlike a lot of other sports, the focus at any point in the game, it always seems to be on like one or two people, right? If you watch a basketball game or a football game, there's a lot going on, a lot of activity. You watch a baseball game, pace is a lot slower, and you know the focus is as an observer, I'm watching the pitcher, then I'm watching the batter, then I'm watching the fielder. So it's a lot of pressure, you know, for young kids and even for adults for that matter. But what I try and emphasize to the kids is, you know, little things that you do matter, right? And what I mean by that is during the course of a game, it could be one little play that a player can do. It could be a base running play, a big hit, you make a defensive out, it could be a pitch. But little things certainly influence the outcome of a game, or, you know, the pace of the game or how things are going. And what I like the kids to take away at the end of each practice or a game is, you know, you did something in some small way that could contribute to the success of the team. And what I try and tell them is they can draw on that outside of baseball, right? So whether it's at school, whether it's, you know, when we're adults and we're in the working world, you know, little things matter, and you can contribute in your small way, your significant way. It's not like basketball where, you know, most of the emphasis is on the kid that scores 20 points a game. It could be a little, you know, a little good base running play that some kid does that, you know, affects the outcome of a game. And I try and, you know, reiterate that to the kids very often, that little things matter. And it's not just in baseball, but in life. So it's a unique sport that way, where you can emphasize the small things and how an individual can contribute.
It's interesting you mention that too, because when you're dealing with kids, and they are kids as much as, sometimes you forget it when they're performing, you can see it when you bring it up, the positive things that a kid does for his team or her team, the look that a kid gets on their faces that they didn't think that anybody was paying attention to it, but somebody saw it. And that really is, it's a big draw for them as far as getting them back for the next time. And Hanson and I talked about it earlier in the context of the Colorado issue, it has to be fun at any level, whether it's high school, whether it's college. Like, everybody has a point where they say, you know what, this game isn't for me anymore. And you really hope that it's not when you're coaching them. You hope that it's years down the road. Hey, you know, you decide that that you're done playing, you're done playing. But you really do need to make it fun, and you do need to engage the kids. And you have a great coaching staff that helps you with it as well. Who are your assistant coaches, and what roles do each of you play?
I'm real lucky with respect to the guys I coach with. I'm with a group of three other guys, Jeremy Hinton, Steve Crowley, Henry Dubois, all of which, you know, have had players in the league for a number of years. We've coached, you know, with each other and against each other for several years, and they're on the coaching staff. So I'm real lucky to have them, you know, with us. Also fortunate in that the way we, you know, things have evolved over the past few years as we worked with these kids, each of us, you know, takes a point of emphasis and works with certain groups of players or a certain part of the game. As an example, you know, Jeremy's very focused on pitchers and catchers, both in practices and in game. Henry's really our hitting guy in terms of developing, you know, hitting approach, how to think about a good batting practice, how to bring that into a game. Steve's more of a defensive, you know, focus during practices and games, as well as you can imagine, once you get into district play and highly competitive play, keeping, you know, the rules of the game, the logistics of the game, substitutions. There's a lot of things that go on during the course of the game that you really need to keep on top of. Steve does a really good job of that for me, to make sure that we're subbing in kids the right way, batting orders aren't missed, rules as we're going through the game. So it works out well with the four of us. I think points of emphasis are evenly distributed. We all have a voice, right, which is really, I think, important, because, you know, there's a lot going on, and different kids have different needs, have different emotional situations, physical, and it's really a good balance, and it's worked great. We've coached together now for, you know, this is the fourth year in a row with this core group of boys, and I'm real lucky to have them with us.
It certainly has to be easy for you, having familiar faces with you in the dugout, particularly when you're thinking about the substitution and the sub rules. I don't think people appreciate how complex that can be. And we're with Mark St. Hilaire, the coach of the Bedford 12-year-old district team. I don't think also people understand the kind of time commitment that it is coaching a district team. What would you figure that you spend in a given week?
Oh, geez. I think about it this way. Over a two-week period as a team, we probably have one day off. So we have some form of baseball activity pretty much every day. Anywhere from an hour and a half to 3.5 hours a day. We'll try and take a day off every couple of weeks. And that's, you know, that's a mix between practices, scrimmages, actual games. But, you know, baseball activity for us is, you know, at this level, it's pretty much every day. We call it 100% commitment. It's evenings during the week. It's throughout the weekends. We try and balance some rest, you know, as needed, arm care, and just, you know, they're kids, and sometimes we need to take a step back and realize, you know, they're 12, and once in a while, you know, we'll go swimming and we'll go to the beach and hang out. But the kids love being there, though. It's I will say, you know, these 13 kids, we're not twisting their arms to show up every day. They're there on time. They're there ready. They're excited. They love playing baseball. So that's the enjoyable thing, is I'm not pushing them to show up every day. They want to be there. And just a great group of kids. But it is a big commitment. And we've made the commitment to each other. And we said that at the beginning. It's, you know, we're best friends. These kids are their 13 best friends for the next, you know, 6 or 8 weeks. And it's a special thing.
It certainly is a lot of fun. So if somebody wants to watch you guys, I know the tournament season starts next week. When's the first game? And when do you guys open up at the complex?
Our first game is this coming Tuesday, the 25th. We have 5 pool play games over the course of about a week and a half. So our first game is Tuesday the 25th. We play Manchester on the road. Our first home game, and we're fortunate, our last 3 pool games are at home. So our first home game is June 29th, which is a Saturday morning at 10 a.m. at the Little League Complex in Bedford where we play Salem. So that'd be the first opportunity for, you know, people outside of the families around the Bedford area to catch a home game. So Saturday the 29th, our schedule's posted on the District 1 Little League website. So if folks that are interested, it's out there. We have it on our internal league site as well, but we're excited to get going. We've been practicing for a few weeks now, and the kids are itching to get that first game.
Awesome. And I know, too, if somebody wants to get updates as well, they should be able to go to the league Facebook page, too, and follow that and see all the exploits. And what Mark didn't mention out of the whole thing is this team, as an 11-year-old group, won the state last year, played very well in a regional tournament as well. So certainly looking forward to watching you guys the rest of the way.
Hey, appreciate it, Lauren.
Cool. All right. Thank you, Mark. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Take care. Have a good day, guys.
You too. So we did it all in one segment again. How do you like that?
Funny how that happens.
Harry's going to kill us, though. We're like 4 minutes over. So anyway, our thanks to our guest, Mark St. Hilaire, the coach of the Bedford 12-year-old district team. Thanks to everybody here at the station, Colleen, Bill Jennings, Harry Kozlowski, although he's not physically here. Thanks to my broadcast partner, Andrew Hansen. And yeah, thanks to you guys for listening. Enjoy a great sports week. We will talk to you next week, I think. I don't know. Summer. So we can talk about more like national stuff and less local stuff. Although I have a feeling this Little League team is going to be a lot of fun to watch along the way. So we will catch you next time. You've been listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1.